This is Marketplace After the Bell. I'm Scott Jagow. And for the next little bit, I'm going to take you on a journey through the week in business and the economy. It wasn't a pretty week, but we'll try to make some sense of things that don't make a whole lot of sense. Here we go. Forgive me, Mr. President, for I have sinned. I've been thinking impure thoughts about selling. I know you told me not to sell. You said buy. Stocks are cheap. And I know I'm supposed to think long term. But sitting in front of my radio this week, listening to the Dow plunge down, down, down below 7,000, I felt weak. A voice in my head screamed, sell! Sell it now, before it's too late. Yeah, stocks are cheap. You can buy Citigroup at the dollar store. And Mr. President, I know you want me to buy it. You said if I hang in there for the long haul, I can make some serious money. But AIG is 35 cents. You want me to buy that junk? Just because something's cheap doesn't make it a good investment. The Dow was down 8,000 points since October of 07. When it hit 12,000, everyone said, it's a great time to buy. So I held on. And then at 10,000, it was a great time to buy. Still holding. Now my knuckles are white hot. But I'm trying to think good thoughts. I'm trying to hang in there. But Mr. President, much more of this, and I will be a sinner. A seller. So help me. It was AIG that started us rolling down the hill this week. The biggest quarterly loss for any company ever. $61 billion. I just have two words. Hedge funds. That's where all the losses are coming from this insurance company. It was a well-run company at one time. Now it's a money pit for the government. And for you, the taxpayer. Because despite what I just told you, we invested more money in AIG this week, another $30 billion. That's AIG's fourth bailout. You and me, we essentially own AIG. I don't want to own it. But now that we do, maybe we should find out a little more about this company. Our Washington reporter Steve Henn is tracking AIG for us.
AIG insures lots of stuff, not just life, property, and casualty. Remember those credit default swaps? Gradient Analytics' Don Vickery says those swaps are basically insurance guaranteeing banks' investments. But AIG
did not appear to understand how to value them, and worse yet, they didn't hedge any of their risks.
Vickery says AIG was an insurance company selling insurance without really understanding the risks.
Right, exactly.
And it's not just mortgage-backed investments that AIG's wrapped up in. The company has lots of business lines.
One of them was selling insurance to European banks.
Paul Krodowski at the Kauffman Foundation says European banking rules allow banks to hold less cash and increase their leverage.
If you went out and got insurance from a provider like AIG.
Today, AIG insures more than $230 billion in European bank investments. Many may be bad. And if AIG defaults on these policies, some big European banks could fail. Analyst Rob Haynes at Credit Sites says when the U.S. Treasury bails out AIG, it's also propping up European banks.
That's true, and it doesn't sound very palatable to a lot of U.S. taxpayers.
The total cost to taxpayers could rise to $250 billion. But Haynes says letting AIG take down Europe's biggest banks would be even pricier.
Okay, I get that letting AIG fail could be very expensive to the financial system. But I don't understand where we're going to draw the line with all these bailouts. I talked about this on my blog, The Scratch Pad, this week. You can read it at marketplace.org. A lot of people weighed in on AIG, and Morning Report host Bill Radke called me into the studio to talk about it.
What's been interesting about what your readers are saying?
And, you know, I think just about everyone hates what's going on here with AIG. And we're just taking it on faith that if AIG collapses, then the entire Western financial system will go under. That's what Bernanke keeps telling us. But I've had people come up to me and say, seriously, what will happen? Will I spontaneously combust? What is the literal consequence of AIG going under? You know, generally it's the lack of loans because this system will have no capital. So, but it's very general, and it just feels like a lot of fear is driving this.
You think the mainstream media tend to faithfully quote the officials and filter out some of the anger that's building out there?
Am I overstating it?
No.
But I think actually a lot of the anger is in the blogosphere.
That's not representative either.
Yeah, and it's not all constructive. You know, there's a lot of negativity that can feed on itself and become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I think that, you know, we have to get it out. We have to we have to express our anger about this, and we have to be able to express the sentiment that taxpayers are shouldering a ridiculous burden now. The government was supposed to be watching and protecting the system. They failed in that respect, and now the government is taking over the system. So it's very difficult for people who have grown up in a capitalist system to understand how we have gone so far the other way. GM is doing a safety dance, isn't it? They've been tiptoeing around bankruptcy for a while now. The company still says it would be disastrous for the economy if it filed Chapter 11. A lot of people agree with that. But I think the options are running out. How long are the taxpayers going to keep investing in GM with the hope that the company can finally turn things around on its own? Well, finally this week, GM did admit Chapter 11 might be coming. And then there's GE. GE stock took a huge drop this week. It's at like $6, $7. We're talking about GE, Bellwether, Blue Chip. It's the bluest of the blue chips. We had to dive into this story. And the man to do it is our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. He is used to bringing bad things to light.
In the past 12 months, shareholders have essentially cashed in roughly $224 billion of the huge conglomerate's market value. And this morning, after three straight days of sharp declines, GE's chief financial officer took the rare defensive step of reassuring shareholders in a live appearance on CNBC. Keith Sharon acknowledged investor worries that the company's finance arm might not have enough cash set aside to cover upcoming losses from real estate loans, credit card defaults, and other financial dealings. But he insisted the company isn't hiding a time bomb.
We can basically fund ourselves all the way through 2010 without any issues, and we don't have any short-term liquidity issues. So I think that credit volatility is overdone.
But that didn't stop the naysayers whose criticism has helped drive down the stock in recent days. Stern AG and Leach analyst Nicholas Heyman says GE may indeed have access to enough cash to run itself through next year. But he points out much of it is being borrowed at low rates with the backing of the federal government.
That's the definition of having access to capital. I mean, the government can't guarantee everything for life.
Heyman says since GE isn't officially a government-rescued bank, it can avoid putting a price on its bad assets right away. And he contends that leaves GE with precious little wiggle room, especially with its industrial businesses struggling.
Whereas it's not anything about to go off a cliff, it's tough times. And right now, on its own, without government assistance, it isn't sustainable.
Analysts say it also hasn't helped that GE sprang a surprise dividend cut on shareholders, many of whom have long counted on GE's dividend as a reliable source of income.
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't have a reliable source of income right now. You know, shareholders and people who work on Wall Street don't like to talk about their feelings. But make no mistake, their feelings do matter. They make decisions based on emotion. For you and me, it's probably not a good example to follow. Marketplace Money host Tess Vigeland talked with Jason Zweig, who writes an investor column for the Wall Street Journal, and Richard Peterson, who's an investment advisor and a psychiatrist. They talked about mental mistakes.
Richard, let me ask you, you know, at a certain point, people see these benchmarks and they think, if I don't get out now, then I'm going to keep having even more to make up for in the long run.
Tess, absolutely. My sense of it is that everyone needs to have their own financial stress management plan. When you invest, you've got to say to yourself, I'm willing to accept this amount of losses or this deterioration in fundamentals.
But how do you know what that level is for you?
Well, it depends on why you got in the first place. Hmm. And one thing that's concerned me about the market these days is I think there's something of a stock ownership bubble. There's a lot of people who have bought stocks without really understanding why they bought stocks. They just were told it goes up 10, 12% a year. It's the best way to beat inflation. It's very important that when people invest, they understand why they're investing. If they're investing for price appreciation, they should also have a pain threshold and say, if it drops this much from this point, I can't take it anymore.
Yeah, Tessa, I mean, I would jump in and add to what Richard is saying that one of the things people really did not understand about stocks until we entered this bear market is there's a reason the long-run return on stocks is higher than anything else. It's because stocks are riskier than anything else. It means that the collapse in stock prices is nature's way of readjusting the stock market to the point at which it becomes almost assured of generating a higher return in the future, but only for the people who still own them.
And it might stay that way. You know, it might stay down at great values for a while, even a decade.
A decade? I'm sure my parents don't want to hear that. But I'm telling you, I'm still thinking positive. Even after a week like this one for the Dow. Monday, down 300. Tuesday, down another 100. Thursday, down 280. Down again today. Jeremy Hobson watches the markets for us from New York. He's been asking the same question every day.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
Are we there yet?
No.
It's a pointless question, says economist Eugene White at Rutgers University.
I would say there's no way you can tell when you've exactly reached the bottom.
The reason? He says it's not like you reach bedrock and can't drill any further.
It's an incorrect geological metaphor. An economy is not a bunch of geological strata. It depends on confidence.
Peter Schiff of Euro-Pacific Capital is not very confident that we're anywhere near a bottom. Schiff's known for his dire economic predictions, and he's been right about most of them.
I think there's going to be a lot of worry and a lot of panic near the bottom. And we haven't had much panic. You know, maybe if we had a 1,000 or 2,000 point down day in the Dow or a couple of those, maybe that would do it. But I think this gradual decline, to me, doesn't look like a bottom.
Schiff says we won't know we've hit bottom until several years later when we look back and see the trend. And Professor White says the trend line is likely to be slow and steady rather than a trampoline jump up. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs seemed to agree today.
I think the American people understand we didn't get into this problem in the beginning of February. So we're not likely to get out of this problem by the end of March.
Of course, that won't keep us from asking.
Are we there yet?
You little...
Oh, I think we're there.
Woohoo!
I'd sure like to choke a few people. But I guess we don't have a choice but to be patient. Keep our heads up and believe that we are going to make it through this. The AIGs and the GMs and the GEs, they will get sorted out. They don't have much choice either. And that is Marketplace After the Bell for this week. I'm Scott Jagow. Hope you can check out my blog, The Scratch Pad. You'll find it at marketplace.org. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.